Good morning. This morning's scripture reading is a parable of Jesus from the Gospel of Matthew. The kingdom of heaven will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. To one he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received 5 bags of gold went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 bags more. So also the one with 2 bags of gold gained 2 more. But the man who had received 1 bag went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received 5 bags of gold brought the other 5. "Master," he said, "you entrusted me with 5 bags of gold. See, I have gained 5 more. His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." The man with 2 bags of gold also came. "Master," he said, "you entrusted me with 2 bags of gold. See, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." Then the man who had received 1 bag of gold came. "Master," he said, "I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you." His master replied, "You wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the banker so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Matthew 25:14-13.
We're now in the fifth and final installment of this series we've been in this winter called How to Change, in which we've been talking about exactly that. How do we become better versions of ourselves? And what we've been saying is that there are things in all of our lives, things that we are doing that are hurting us and hurting others, and things that we are not doing, that if we just did those things, we would be better off, and all the people in our lives would be better off. And we know what those things are. But the way the Apostle Paul put it is, he said, I don't do the good things that I want to do, and the evil things I don't want to do, I keep on doing. And then he says, "Wretched man that I am." So that's what this series has been about. That's basically the theme verse, theme passage for the series. And it's a series about how can we be a little bit less wretched? How can we just do some of these things that we say we want to do and stop doing the ones we don't? And I've been using myself as a guinea pig for the series. So in week one, I confessed, you know, that feeling exactly where Paul was at, where I just couldn't do the things I wanted to do and was doing all these things I didn't want to do. And I said, you know, I'm unqualified, really, to lead this series. And now, looking back, I realized that it was all part of a plan, that I was perfectly qualified to lead the series because I needed it more than anybody. So if this has done nobody else in here any good, that's fine, because it's worked for me. It's worked for me. All the things at the beginning of the series I said I'm not doing and I am doing, it's all reversed. I'm doing all the stuff that I've always wanted to do and not doing all those things that I didn't want to do. It has worked for me. And so now I'm asking the question, you know, now I'm like the poster child. Now I'm like, well, what happened? You know, like what did it? What flipped the switch? So that's what I want to talk about this morning. Two things this morning. And again, this whole series has been, each sermon's kind of like an overlap of the one before and review. They're not really distinct or discrete. So, and the two things aren't going to be even length. So the first thing is going to be shorter. And it's going to be an idea that we haven't really talked about since week one, but I want to come back to that. The second thing, which we're going to spend most of our time on, is same thing we talked about last week, same thing we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks. And I had a whole, this happened again, I had a whole different sermon this morning written based on the parable of the talents, which we're not going to be talking about at all. And I hope to give that sermon at some point. But as I was looking at it this morning, I thought, man, I've got one last shot. I've got one last shot to talk about this. What do I want to say? And I just want to go back to what we talked about last week and say it again and say, no, really. No, seriously. Reese, our 8-year-old, our oldest, she does this thing where if I do something she thinks is embarrassing, she goes, seriously, Dad? And that's what this is. It's seriously. Like, this is, I'm not joking. And so that's what we're going to spend most of our time on. But first, step one for me, the first thing that did the trick for me, going back to something we talked about in week one, the first thing that I did to become less wretched over the last 5 weeks was to own my own wretchedness, to just admit it, to just say, yes, this happened. And I did it publicly in front of all of you. You know, I said, this is how bad things have gotten. I love that word, wretch. It comes from the Old English word, wrecka, which, you know, Old English words, linguists still theorize today that the words that come from the Old English, as opposed to borrowed words that come from Latin or Greek, still resonate with us more on an emotional level. So, for example, if you look at the writings and speeches of Lincoln, the amount that he used words with Old English roots versus his contemporaries who used all these big Latin and Greek words, it's amazing. So that's beside the point. Wretch, wrecka. The Old English word wrecka meant somebody who was lost, an outsider, a wanderer, somebody wandering aimlessly. There's even this famous Old English poem from the 10th century called The Wanderer that uses this word wrecka over and over again. This person that's just an exile almost, wandering aimlessly. And if you think about the most famous usage of the word wretch in English, it's Amazing Grace. But think about the line that comes after. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost. And that's what it is to be a wretch. It's to be lost. It's to be an outsider to your own life. It's to be a stranger to your own home. You're not where you're supposed to be. God put you on earth to be in a certain spot, to have a certain role, to do a certain job, and to be wretched is to be far from home. If you think about the prodigal son story, which we talked about a few weeks ago, that's wretchedness. He's far from home, and he comes to his senses, and he realizes it, and he turns around. What they call that in recovery circles, you know, 12-step AA, and everybody has heard this because it's been popularized, they call it hitting bottom. And it's widely misunderstood. You know, people think of hitting bottom as like a circumstantial thing. They think of it, primarily they think of it in terms of substance abuse, and they think hitting bottom is like, you know, the heroin addict when they're on the street and they have no money left. And that's not what it is. Hitting bottom is an internal thing, and it can happen whether or not your circumstances have fallen apart. And it's just saying, look, I have been sliding. I have been sliding really far, and the slide stops here. This is the bottom. This is the bottom. I'm turning around. And just owning exactly how bad things have gotten. You know, the obstacle to this is the guilt. You don't want to face it. You don't want to face how far you've slid, and so you just try to not think about it and not look at it. But to turn around, you got to own it. When the prodigal son comes home, he doesn't try to save face. He doesn't try to say, well, actually, it was a pretty good trip, you know. He just says, I'm a wretch. I'm a complete wretch. So you got to own that for yourself, and then you've also got to do the other thing I did in week one, which is confess it publicly. You know, again, it's funny. I didn't do this on purpose. I didn't fake this. If I ever did try to fake something like this, God would strike me down with lightning. But instead of telling you what to do in the first week, I just modeled it. I just did it. And I just said publicly, you know, here's where I'm at. Now, all of you don't have the privilege of getting to stand up in front of a crowd and have this free personal therapy session. which means you got to do something else, which is what we talked about in week two. You got to make use of your community group. And what I know about community groups, after having been in a lot of community groups for a lot of years, is without having been in any of your groups, I know this for a fact, that some of you have been talking around the edges of your wretchedness. You've been talking about it in these very vague, very amorphous terms to save face, and it's not going to do anything. It's not going to help at all unless you own it, unless you own how bad things have gotten. That's the only way to stop the slide. So that's the first thing I wanted to talk about this morning. And the first thing that happened for me in week one, without even realizing I was doing the first step, is I just owned it and I confessed it. But as I said, I want to spend the majority of our time just talking again about the same thing we talked about last week, just saying, no, seriously, really, for real. And the second thing that's made the difference for me over the last 5 weeks, by far, is this willingness to realize that I'm in a fight, this willingness to start fighting again. You know, you think about this word lost. We're talking about being wretched, lost. I am lost. Well, there's different ways you can use that same word. You can say, I am lost, or you can say, I lost, like I lost the battle, I lost the game. And they're the same thing. The way you get lost, the way you become a wretch, the way you end up way far from where you're supposed to be is because you keep losing. And if you're losing, that means that somebody else is winning. You know, we have this phrase, oh, I'm my own worst enemy. Well, that's not true. That's not true. And if you think you're your own worst enemy, that means you're totally blind to your real worst enemy, and he's having a heyday. And for me, what has flipped the switch is just realizing, well, wait a minute, how did I get here? How did I end up doing all these things I said I didn't want to do? How did I end up not doing all these things I was doing before, these good things that were helping me, and all of a sudden I'm not doing them anymore? How did this happen? How did I end up so lost unless somebody was trying to get me lost? And what that did is it awakened in me this desire to fight for my own life, because somebody's trying to take it away from you. That's what Jesus says. He calls him the thief. He says, the thief comes to kill and destroy and to steal. And that's what he wants to do. He wants to take your life, the one life that God has given you. He wants to take it from you. And realizing this, realizing the reality of the devil, has become for me over the last month this interpretive key that like unlocks the mysteries of the universe. All of a sudden, everything makes sense. You know, the Bible didn't make sense before, now the Bible makes sense. World history didn't make sense, now world history makes sense. My life and my experience as a pastor, it all makes sense if you just remember this. For example, why do so many marriages go south? Why is marriage so hard? Even some of you in this room right now, your marriage is on the brink. Why does that happen so often? You know, when people get to that point, they say, well, you know, I'm going to have to fight for my marriage. Well, you should have been fighting for it all along. See, that's the problem. Not just investing in it, not just maintaining it, but fighting for it because somebody is trying to take it from you. The better something is, the better a gift something is from God, the more the devil has to ruin it. Why? Because his objective is to get us to believe the lie that God is not good. So if God gives us a good thing, like marriage or sex or whatever it is, that's evidence contrary to his point. He's got to corrupt that evidence. He's got to do something to screw with that evidence if we're going to believe his case and believe his lie. He's trying to steal your marriage from you. The problem is not some other man or some other woman. They're just a pawn. You got a bigger problem than that. You say, are you trying to scare me? No, I'm not saying you should be scared, but I am saying you should be pissed off. You know, this should fire you up. This should light a fire under you that somebody is trying to take this from you, and you should wake up and remember that you got to fight. And the other thing it should do is it should reset your expectations about how hard or how easy things are going to be. I realized for me that the problem was waking up and thinking, this should be easy. You know, what's wrong with me? Why is this so hard? Well, it just is, because it's a war. You know, it's like a soldier in the middle of a battle being like, why is everyone shooting at me? You know, or we've been talking about football. You know, it's a football player running down the field and like, why is everyone trying to hurt me? I'm just like running. It's you know, what's the problem? You're in the middle of a fight. You're in the middle of a war. And if you just realize that, it's still hard, but it's not as hard as this confusion, this absolute bewilderment of why are things so hard? Why is everyone shooting at me? Well, that's just what it is. There is no easy. There's only two choices, hard and harder. Winning is hard. Losing is harder. And if you go for easy, you get harder, because easy is an illusion. There is no easy. So if you keep seeking after easy, you just get your ass handed to you over and over and over again, and you get harder instead. And if you just embrace hard, if you just say, you know what, to win, it's going to be hard. To win, it's going to take some effort. Then you get the better of the two options. It's not easy, but it still can be fulfilling. It still can be deeply fulfilling to win. Winning is fun. I was thinking about this with parenting. You know, the times that parenting is the worst, and most, you know, they've done all these surveys across the board, universally, people become way less happy when they have kids. That is just a fact. Like, as far as, like, sociological things we know that for sure. Why is that? Why do people become less happy? I think it's a matter of expectations. And for me, when my expectations are out of whack, when I think that my kids are like these accessories for me to take on vacation and cuddle with, and that they're just gonna be sweet, you know, and I come home and I'm like, why are you doing that? Like, why are you acting that way? And I'm just so confused and bewildered, when the fact is, like, if they didn't misbehave, then what am I there for? You know, that's the job. That's what I signed up for. That's what I'm supposed to do. Just do your job. Just accept it for what it is. I remember the first time that Brittany left me with all four girls on my own. So Dottie was a baby, and it was, you know, for the whole weekend. So from Friday after school till she wasn't coming home till they were in bed on Sunday night. And so I, you know, I was kind of nervous, and I thought about it ahead of time, and I absolutely crushed it. Like, it was the best weekend I've ever had with them. I never lost my temper. I never became impatient. I just was on the entire time. It was just amazing. And I felt so good after I put them in bed on Sunday night, after those 48 hours. And I thought, what was the deal? Like, why was this weekend so much better than an average weekend? And my first thought, of course, was that the problem this whole time has been Brittany. But then I thought about it a little more. And I realized it was about expectations. For 2 or 3 days before that weekend, I had been planning it out in my mind. I had documents. I got up at 6 o'clock, you know, an hour before the girls got up, to like get my game face on, to be in the right state when they got up. Because if I knew if I started out behind, I was going to be behind the whole weekend. I showed up ready to fight. And because I showed up ready to fight, I won. And winning feels good, you know? It's not like it was like all drudgery. Like, winning at this battle of parenting felt good. There was joy in it. But I had to be willing to admit, this is hard, and I'm going to show up for the battle. And it's like that. It's like that in whatever area of our life it is, whether it's personal change or your marriage or parenting or reading the Bible. The devil doesn't want you to read the Bible. He doesn't want you to. Of course it's going to be hard, but you got to fight. You got to fight for it. And if you don't, he will steal your life from you. The passage that I would have used for this morning, if I had thought of it earlier, is this passage from 2 Samuel about the life of David. So I want to take a few minutes with the time we have left to tell this story in detail. Most of you know the first part of the life of David, but there's a little bit more to the story That's pretty interesting, and it's a perfect example of this principle that we're talking about you have to fight, and if you don't, everything you have is going to be taken from you. So David starts out, you know, the thing that makes David great is his willingness to fight. That is David. That's his greatness. He shows up, and there's this enemy, Goliath, and everybody's just not doing anything. And David says, well, somebody's got to fight him. Like, we can't just stand here. They can't just continue like this. So he fights Goliath, but it's not just about Goliath. He does that through his whole life. What makes him have this meteoric rise is that he's this incredibly aggressive general, and he just keeps fighting, keeps fighting, keeps fighting. In that day and in that time, the national situation was such, you know, got all these tribes, that either you are taking the fight to the enemy on their territory, or they're taking the fight to you on your territory. And that's exactly how it is for us. You know, this has unlocked the whole Bible for me. I've always wondered, why is so much of the Bible just this boring military history? Well, because that's what we're in. We're in a war. And so David's greatness was his willingness to fight. He's like General Grant. The American Civil War would have been over in 1 year instead of five. The 4 years were the 4 years it took Lincoln to find Grant. And when people ask him, what's so great about Grant, he said, it's not his strategy, it's just that he fights. He's willing to fight. All the other generals just were scared to fight. And that's what made David so great. So everything good he has is because of his willingness to fight. He's king over Israel. He's united this kingdom. And then there is this ominous line in 2 Samuel 11 where it says, in the spring, when kings go away to war, David sent Joab. In the spring, when kings go away to war, David sent Joab. Joab is his general. Joab is his right-hand man. David is the king. It's David's job to go to war. It's David's job to fight. And this one time, he says, going back to the voice that we talked about last week, you know, the voice says, you know, it's not going to be that big a deal if you just skip this one campaign, this one season. And he says, yeah, you're right. It's not a big deal. I'll just skip this one campaign. And he stays home. And starting with that decision, he is lost. Why? Because he's not where he's supposed to be. There's somewhere he's supposed to be. There's a path that he's supposed to be on, and he's not on it. So now he's wandering. And once you start wandering, who's to say what's going to happen next? So he's up on the roof, and he sees this woman bathing, and the voice says, "Yeah, it's not that big a deal to watch, you know, to stand here and just take in the view for a few minutes. It's not like it's adultery." And he says, "Yeah, that's true." And so he just watches. And of course, it wasn't adultery until it was. And then, you know, even with the adultery, you could say, "Well, you know, nobody got hurt. Big deal. It happens. There are no consequences." And of course, there weren't any consequences until there were, when she's pregnant. And you say, well, even then, you know, I mean, it's not like somebody got hurt, you know, it's just a baby being brought into the world. There's a way to work this out. You know, nobody got hurt until they did, because he orders that this woman's husband, who is where he's supposed to be, who's doing his job, who is out in the battle that David's supposed to be fighting, he orders that man be sent to the front lines and all the troops pull back so that he's killed. And what you see is you see a warrior, David, a man after God's own heart, being absolutely manhandled by the enemy, being absolutely destroyed, losing, 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 losing. Now, the part you may not know, you've all heard that part. The part you may not know is that he didn't hit bottom there. That's not where the slide stopped. It just gets worse from there, because what happened, you know, so what has he done? He's abdicated his responsibility. He's abdicated his responsibility as king. He has no moral authority as king, and he has no moral authority in his household now that he's stolen some other man's wife. So the next thing that happens is, you know, a couple years later, his daughter gets raped, and it's somebody within the palace, And David, because he's lost his moral authority and lost his bearings, David doesn't do anything about it. He's angry, but he just turns a blind eye because that's easier. And so his son, Absalom, sees this and is furious. Absalom has to take it on himself to do something about it. 2 years later, Absalom kills the guy. But he's so disgusted with his father. He's so disgusted with his father's abdication of responsibility and lack of integrity that at that point, Absalom decides, forget it, I'm going to take over. Now, the other thing that David had done is, so what's his job as king? In that day, the king was also the chief justice of the Supreme Court. So he would sit in the seat in the gate, they call it. The gate was kind of the court where business was done, where legal disputes were settled. And that was his seat. That's where he was supposed to sit in the gate of the city, and he would literally hold court. People would come, and he'd talk to the people and settle disputes. Well, when all this stuff went down with Bathsheba and then, not going to war and the husband being killed and the rape, David just stops going out to his seat. He just doesn't go anymore. He just stays inside the palace. So Absalom starts going out to the gate and starts taking David's seat at the gate. And when people come, he starts poisoning them against David. He says, my father would say this probably, but I'll tell you what I would say. And over a couple years, Absalom was able to raise a coup, and he drives David from his own kingdom, from the palace. He leads a revolt. His own son leads a revolt, and David is on the run in the wilderness somewhere. Talk about having your life stolen from you. Everything good you have stolen from you, all because going way back, you weren't willing to fight and wanted to take it easy. And there's a war then, and David still isn't fighting the war. It's a war against his own son. And David's men, Joab, the same general that David sent out in the first place, the first war, they win. They win against Absalom eventually, but they kill Absalom in the process. And so on the day of victory, they come back into the palace, and David is still so out of sorts. He's up in the palace. All of his men have just fought this victory for him, without his help, and he's up in the palace just weeping about Absalom, his son, just crying about his son that was lost. And there's this stunning passage in 2 Samuel 19 where Joab, the general, goes and confronts David, God's anointed. And he says, look, all those guys out there just risked their lives for you. I'm sorry your son is dead. It seems like you would rather all of us be dead and have your son back, the son that was trying to take your kingdom and wanted you dead, by the way. I'm sorry that your son is dead, but let me tell you this. If you don't get out there right now, if you don't get out there and get back in the gate right now, get back in your seat right now, this is your last chance. This is the last opportunity you have to take your life back. And so it says in that chapter, the bookend to where, in chapter 11, when the kings go off to war, David stayed home. In chapter 19, it says, then the king went and took his seat in the gate, and the people came to him. You can take it back. You can take your place back. You can get back in the gate. You can get back in your seat and get back to doing what you're supposed to do and living the life you're supposed to live, but you just have to make that decision. I was thinking about this in my own life, in terms of abdication of responsibility. It's a new lens to talk about the same thing. We've been talking about doing things you don't want to do or not doing things you do want to do. But thinking about this David story made me think about it in terms of abdication of responsibility. And when I thought about, what that looked like for me in those 4 or 5 months where I wasn't living the way I wanted to be living, the main thing that came to mind was, with my girls, since my girls have been able to talk since they were two, every night I've read my girls' Bible stories. And starting in September, I just stopped. I just stopped doing it. I just didn't do it one night. And then I didn't do it two nights. And I didn't do it three nights because it was easier to not do it. It was just easier. We'd get in there and they asked me all these hard questions and they'd argue about where they were going to sit and I was tired and it just was easier to not do it. So started with that, and then it even got to the point where, you know, the other thing I've done every night since I've been a dad is actually put them to bed, you know, tucked them in, gotten them their water, sang them a song, said a prayer. And one night, you know, I was tired and in a bad mood, and Brittany offered to do it for me, and so I let her do my job. And then I let her do it a second night, and then I let her do it a third night, and then all of a sudden I wasn't doing it anymore. And I was supposed to be in my seat in the room, and I was out in the living room doing whatever I was doing. And you say, well, you know, I mean, it's not the end of the world if you don't read your girls the Bible, except that it sort of is, because if I don't read them the Bible, who's gonna? They've got one dad. One dad. And if I don't do my job, nobody is gonna do it for me. And according to Hebrews 12, you've got all of the saints and angels looking down and saying, Ryan, just do your job. Just read them the Bible. And you've got an enemy whispering in my ear saying, it'll be fine. It's not that big a deal. It's that cartoon gimmick about, you know, the angel on one shoulder and the demon on the other. And we think we're so smart. You know, we think we're so educated, and it's just a cartoon, and the medium is the message. And what that is that's a simplistic metaphor for what's really going on, which is, you know, there's this struggle between your prefrontal cortex and your amygdala. That's what's really happening there. I read that in the New York Times. That's what we think. You know what it really is? It's this idea of a struggle between your prefrontal cortex and your amygdala is an overly complex metaphor for what's really going on, which is that you got an angel on one shoulder and a demon on the other. Literal angel, literal demon. Talk about an abdication of responsibility. You know, if I don't tell you the devil's real, who's gonna? And I've been so afraid of scaring you off that I've been playing right into the enemy's hands. Literal angel, literal demon, and all of eternity, all of your life and the lives of those you touch hang in the balance. You have a choice. So what I want to say to you as we close this series is the same thing that Joab said to David. You got to get out there. You got to get back in the gate. You've got to take your seat back. Jesus said, the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy, but I have come to give you your life back. But he can't give it back to you unless you take it back. Let's pray.